Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to State Government Finance. I understand a quorum is present, and we will commence the meeting. Thank you so much. We have three sets of minutes to approve, starting with the minutes from April 11th. I would like to ask a member to make a motion to approve the minutes.
I move the approval of the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Are there any discussion for the minutes? All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes from April 11th are approved. This is new to me. Thank you.
You're doing great.
Thank you. I would ask a member to call a motion for the February 13th minutes.
So moved.
Representative Olson moves the minutes. Any discussion? I ask for the ayes to approve the minutes. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? The minutes from February 13th are approved. I ask for a motion for the February 17th minutes.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Any discussion? All those in favor of approving the February 17th minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are approved. I will please turn the chair back over to the chair. Thank you.
You're doing such a good job.
Ugh, stressful.
Lovely roads.
Not the roads, it's the drivers.
Yeah, it's the combination. When you leave an hour early, it takes you 3 hours to get here. It's anyway. First bill is House File. I see House File 354, and I moved House File 354 to be held over for possible inclusion in a supplemental appropriations bill. Representative Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you. I was observing the motions on the approval of the minutes, and yesterday in Ways and Means, Representative Olson was making the same set of motions to approve our minutes. I think we had three sets yesterday as well, and you had, well, two today that you moved, and the third one was Representative Elkins, but at any rate, a little catch-up. This bill was before us last year and was favorably acted upon by the House. But by way of background, this bill would request a one-time appropriation of $1.6 million in funding for Beyond Opioids, a statewide opioid education and prevention project. Beyond Opioids is a partnership between Twin Cities Public Television, AMPRS, and the Minnesota Public Television Association. The National Safety Council has determined that Americans are more likely to die of an opioid overdose than a car accident. Recent statistics show here in Minnesota there are 3.5 million prescriptions written for opioids in just 1 year. Our state is facing what is truly an epidemic that is getting worse. There is no question that we need that we need addiction counseling and treatment, but we also need education and prevention, and that's the role that we would like to play with this appropriation to public television and public radio. Beyond Opioids will leverage the power of media to educate Minnesotans about the opioid crisis, empower people to share their stories, prevent opioid abuse, and connect people to the resources they need for help. I'm joined this morning by Dean Orton, who is with Twin Cities Public Television, and Joe Glazer, who is with Public Radio. And I know that you have a very tight timeline, Mr. Chairman, but they are prepared to make a few comments. The one thing that I want to stress, because Ways and Means will later be working with targets, the forecast from November shows a very tight number relative to continued funding, $255 million by that forecast. When you read in the newspaper the $1.3 billion, most of that is available for one-time appropriations. So because of the nature of this particular project, this would fall into the category if the February forecast is similar to the November forecast in the one-time funding category. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would turn it over to our
testifiers. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Yes. Good morning. Dean Orton, Chief Operating Officer for Twin Cities PBS. Thank you for the opportunity here this morning. Our collective remarks will just be a few minutes apiece. Sit here in front of you today representing a very unique collaboration consortium of 24 public media organizations that serve this state. They reach all 87 counties throughout. That is in your cars, in your homes, through mobile devices. And we've been asking ourselves, with the power of public media that reaches millions and is so trusted, how might we make a difference in the opioid addiction and epidemic that goes on with that and the related drugs? And we're asking today for your support. We're hoping that we'd have a 25th member join this consortium, that being the state of Minnesota, in a unique, powerful public media basically a unique, powerful state partnership, public and private partnership through this initiative over the next couple years. I know you're very aware of the complex nature of this problem. I won't spend a lot of time. Representative Carlson already mentioned a lot of the grave statistics, but more than anything, how this consortium might make a difference. And I'd emphasize a couple things, and maybe the analogy is that of kind of pollution in a river. Some of the work we'd like to do is, when there's issues already in the river downstream, how do we help address some of those issues? I know that the state, you're spending significant dollars and resources to help system and handle the problem once it exists. We certainly are willing to put over $1 million of our resources on this part of where the problem is at, helping people aware to how do they connect to services and resources that are available to them once there's already an issue, once we're already having to deal with the issues that are being created because of the drug issues. The other part, and the most exciting part of this initiative, where we're really interested is how do we stop those kind of pollutants and contaminants even getting in the river in the first place? And for us, that's this idea of prevention. What can we do to help eliminate and reduce at least an effective level of what even gets in the river in that first place? And we think that that's where the power of media, we hope that you put that in your tools here in the state of Minnesota. For the stories that we can tell. We'll do that in three ways that I think are extremely powerful. One, we're really good at complex issues. Public media figures out how to take the very complex and help people understand so that there can actually be some level of empathy, some level of hope. Unfortunately, media can be part of the problem or can be part of the solution. Too often, the media is making this whole problem seem quick sound bites, quick stories that make the whole thing seem hopeless. What can I possibly do when it feels this grave, this much trouble? So I think our media can do an excellent job at really addressing kind of the complexity, but give a better sense of what things can be done and better understanding of what is possible. The second front is, if this initiative go forward, is that us as a 25-member organization collectively working together is the multiplier effect. We've seen time and time again when we do this private-public partnership with the state of Minnesota and public media that others rally around us. The last time we did a similar model around the issues of Vietnam, we had over 100 nonprofits that joined, all states, all kinds, government agencies, libraries, school systems, organizations that were on the ground providing services. This, again, we think this work, because of the nature of media, because of the nature of storytelling, we will see that kind of multiplier effect. Others will rally, and this is the kind of effort we collectively need to make a difference in trying to make a difference with the epidemic. The third part of what we think we can do in the area of prevention, my colleague will spend a little bit more time on this, is the idea of some of the most powerful tools we have and resources we have are the people themselves who've experienced it close and firsthand. And our focus on peer-to-peer storytelling and leveraging the stories and sharing the stories of those who are most dramatically affected and know more about this than anyone is where our storytelling has got an increased focus in how we can approach this initiative over the next year. So again, we think we can do some really amazing work to help work with the state to help people better understand on the connecting side of what resources are available once there is issues to deal with. And again, where we think we can really be unique is using the power of media to address the issue before, in terms of human behavior before it even starts, or how we can help prevent. And so this initiative, proven model that we've deployed in the past, we feel strongly we can make a difference. Again, it's only if we collectively come together, and we'd like to do that. I'll turn over the rest of the time for Joel Glazer.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Nelson. For the record, my name is Joel Glazer, and I am the CEO of AMPRS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. First off, like Dean, I would like to thank all of you for your support last year for getting this bill passed and passed through the House. And I'd especially like to thank those of you who reached out to your colleagues on the Senate side to try and get that passed through on that side as well. Unfortunately, we're here today because we were not as successful on the Senate, but hopefully that will change with your support this year. As most of you know, AMPRS is an association of 18 different community radio stations throughout the state of Minnesota, primarily serving underserved communities. I mentioned the underserved part because underserved communities are being hit especially hard by the opioid crisis. According to the Minnesota Department of Health, African Americans are twice as likely to die of an opioid overdose than whites. AMPRS stations KMOJ here in the Twin Cities, known as the People Station, serves primarily African American community. Native Americans are five times more likely than white Minnesotans to die of an opioid overdose. And four of our stations are licensed to and serving Native American communities in Minnesota. But it's not just Native Americans, African Americans, and people in rural communities that are being impacted by opioids. That's why we approached TPT and the Minnesota Public Television Association. They deliver the masses, and we are going to team up to deliver the underserved communities. It's really the perfect partnership to take the lead in educating and preventing opioid addiction. A couple of quick statistics that have updated since I was here last. More than 70,000 Americans died of an overdose on the most recent survey. More than half of those were from opioids. Every 11 minutes, someone in the US dies of an opioid overdose. During our short testimony today, someone will most likely die in the U.S. of an opioid overdose. But let's bring that home here to Minnesota. In the last week of 2019, just a few weeks ago, St. Paul saw a significant spike with 34 overdoses between December 27th and January 3rd. 34 overdoses in a week right here in our capital city. Two of them were fatal. Experts blame the increase in fentanyl popping up on the streets of St. Paul. It's a powerful synthetic opioid similar to morphine, but 50 to 100 times more potent. So those are all staggering statistics, but they're just numbers. The opioid crisis is much more than numbers. It's a crisis involving people, your constituents, your friends. When visiting two of our Native stations, I had one station employee tell me that he and his wife were addicted to opioids. He and his wife both had chronic pain. He knew she was addicted stronger than he was, so he would sleep with the pills in his pocket out of concern for her safety, and woke one morning to find her dead of an overdose. The shocking part of that story, he is still, despite losing his wife, he is still addicted today. Last year I told you about somebody I had learned who was from one of our other Native stations, who had kicked the addiction, and I was excited to tell you he was at MCTC to become an addiction counselor. Unfortunately, the story doesn't end there. Since that time, he has relapsed and is using again, and that's because the relapse rate is so incredibly high with this drug. And that's why we have to educate and stop people before they take their first pill. Addictions can start in just 5 days. Beyond opioids, we'll use the power of storytelling to educate and help prevent future drug addictions. It's a proactive rather than a reactive approach to combating the epidemic. We know and we agree there needs to be more Narcan on the streets, more treatment centers, but there also needs to be outreach, education, and prevention, and that's exactly what this project is going to do. As a society, we can't just treat those who are addicted. We have to prevent those from becoming addicted. We needed to learn more about the warning signs, when to get help and where to get help, not just where, but where in their specific community they can turn for help. The stories will produce and capture people's attention, and then we will have the ability to direct them geographically to culturally appropriate centers in their community. We'll teach them how to avoid getting addicted in the first place. Representative Carlson started off our testimony by pointing out that Americans are now more likely to die of an opioid overdose than a car accident, and that's incredibly sad in so many ways. Perhaps the biggest reason, there's only so much you can do to prevent a car accident, but there's a lot that can be done to prevent opioid-related deaths, and there's a lot you as lawmakers can do. One of those things is to fund our state opioid education and prevention campaign that puts a special emphasis on Minnesota's communities hardest hit by the opioid crisis. Please support House File 354, a one-time appropriation of $1.6 million to help combat the epidemic. Please also do everything in your power to convince your colleagues on the Senate side to support the companion bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, very quickly, my final comments before, if you're going to go to questions, you all had in your packet the handout Beyond Opioids. I think it was in everybody's packet. And if you look at the statement that's highlighted in the circle there, nearly half of all Americans know someone who has struggled with prescription opioid abuse. And yet virtually all Americans, 93%, think it will not happen to them. And really that's what, in my view, this bill is all about, the education so that people become aware of the potential risks. They just don't think it'll happen to them, and yet we know huge numbers in our population are impacted.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Prevention is something that I've been pushing for in many different issues, but one thing about prevention is that you have to recognize where the problem is, and not just recognize that there is a problem, but where it's coming from, how did it start. Do you have any kind of curriculum as to what you're going to do? I mean, you're telling us your broad plan, but what is the curriculum that you're going to be using, and how are you going to get it to the kids? Because that's where you're going to have to start, is at the younger ages. Helping people addicted is great, I'm all for it, but if you don't get to the younger folks, then you're just spinning your wheels because you got a whole new group coming in. So what is the curriculum that you're using, and is it proven? Can you tell us that, can you show us where it's worked, or are you just guessing?
Mr. Glaze.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Green, there is research to support the fact that storytelling is a very powerful ability to address prevention and combat opioid use. That's not just coming from us. On the second page, it'll actually show you that the Center for Disease Control points to research that shows media can play a powerful role in raising awareness about substance abuse and promoting prevention, especially when it's grounded in storytelling in a peer-to-peer messaging fashion. So this is backed up with research from the Center for Disease Control about how peer-to-peer storytelling, whether that's adults, whether that's working with children, which we will be doing also, and doing outreach into the schools. So it's that ability to connect on a human, real basis, as opposed to this is not your brain and your brain on drugs campaign that you may remember from the 80s, and don't do drugs are bad. This is proven that storytelling can connect and can prevent the addiction on the front end.
Representative Green.
Thank you, but it doesn't really answer my question. I don't think you can answer my question right here. I want to know what the curriculum is that you're using. You're going to be telling stories, or you just going to have people who are already addicted go and tell a story on camera and put it in front of kids? What is the message that you're going to be delivering that's going to make the impact? And I'm not trying to be nasty and mean here. I really want to know.
Mr. Glazer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Green, and I believe Dean has a comment after as well. This is not the first time we have embarked on something like this. We've been very successful with Take Control, Prevent, and Manage Diabetes in a very similar fashion. We also did something around quit smoking and keeping tobacco sacred in the Native communities. We will work with experts in the industry. We are the experts in the storytelling. We will also partner with experts in the prevention category, in the counseling and prevention, and we will share stories of success of people that have and that can be used as models to follow. It will also be sharing stories of failure that can be used as a, for lack of a better term, a scare tactic. But the curriculum will be developed with the experts. It's not just, we don't just sit down and say, tell us your story about addiction. They will share nuggets of information that can help people to either find the warning signs, what they can do, steps they can take. For starters, one big step is getting it out of their home, because one of the biggest ways that people get addicted is there are drugs left at home that should have been disposed of. So educating warning signs, things like that. And so do we have it fully prepared and ready to go? No, but do we have a very solid game plan? Yes.
Thank you, Joel. Build on it. Excellent. Mr. Orton, Dean Orton, thank you. Excellent question. And I point to the history of public media as it's statistically, year over year, one of the number one trusted sources of teachers in the classroom. We got that reputation not by accident. We got that reputation because, one, we understand the power of media, but we also understand the ability to work with experts in the field. And our storytellers in this process will be the same, where, as I mentioned, the ripple effect, the multiplier effect, we will rally some of the best minds on the topic when they understand public media wants to do something important in this state to help prevent. And we will leverage the expertise of those individuals who understand the psychological development and the stage of where students are at. And we'll even empower the students themselves in the process to figure out what is the voice, what is the messaging that works. So while I can't give you specific answers to exactly the word per se, I guarantee you the process and the diligence that goes into figuring out an initiative like this is what we put in place. And it will be with those that really can contribute and come up with the right outcomes that we're after. And that's part of our process, part of our journey. It certainly is going to be the focus to make sure this work makes a difference. So I appreciate the question, and certainly a space that we would continue to thrive in and use the methods that we've used in the past.
Just one more comment. I guess, I see this a lot, and I my hat's off to you for trying this, but you've had this around, this proposal around for a while. Came up last year. And if it happens to not go through this year, I would encourage you to go ahead and get that information before you come here, because $1.6 million is a lot of money, and it looks like you're just kind of a grasping at a straw when I think the information is out there and you should have it by now in the amount of time that you've been working on this. So it would be nice to say, this is what it is, we know it works, here's exactly what we're going to do, instead of we're going to have some people tell their stories and hope for the best.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the storytelling, frankly, from schools, it's been very helpful of where you've got success stories from someone that graduated from that school or at least lived in that city. Tragedies. I saw when a local student died in a car crash, that really grabbed the students. So I assume that you're going to have global stories, but I would hope that you'd have a mix of localized, because of, in the stations, to assist with that. And then, this is a dire, topic. But I believe I heard that the life expectancy for the U.S. went up. And one of the stories indicated
the major contributor to that was an improvement in, you know, decrease in drug overdoses. So I hope that you, when you look at that, if, you know, the author said that it's getting worse in Minnesota, if the, in the U.S. it improved, maybe we can look at some of the areas where there was a improvement and learn and borrow from there. And it wouldn't be bad to feedback success information to the legislature. So maybe if there's any comments on those areas.
Mr. Horton.
Yes, I think that the type of storytelling you're talking about where you can point to where there has been a difference made, and you can bring that forward for people to see where there's been a difference made in any example. And that story, we continue to find those stories really powerful because they motivate others to realize if they can do it, so can we. And so we, as part of our initiatives, we want to find out where you can find solution-based journalism. Where are there solutions? Where are there people that are making a difference? How can you bring the power of media to amplify and draw attention? Too often, the media spends all its time on the negative, and it will not spend the kind of time where public media can step forward and really put the bright light on areas where there is a difference and there is capability. And that has a huge effect on motivating other communities and pushing in the right direction. So that's definitely an important part of this storytelling initiative about this work, is to find those places that we can rally around and then share and put ample light on it. You're right.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I've been listening to this discussion and looking at the proposal here, over the weekend I watched or observed a storytelling, if you will, Leech Lake Band tribal leaders talking about opioid addiction and having lost two family members within that. I think it is a powerful thing. But in looking at the numbers here, I see that the Department of Admin takes a piece of this grant, reducing the net proceeds to a little more than $1.5 million. And I'm presuming, and this is what I would like to ask you to clarify for me, I'm presuming that a certain amount of that appropriation is a production cost to create a program to go out and tape and film and create the story. I see that allocation is 70% to Twin Cities Public Television and about 30% to affiliates. So could you talk a little bit about what it costs to produce a program, whether it's 30 minutes or 60 minutes, how much money is left over for really distributing this program or the story, how much airtime does it really receive, and then maybe even comment about what your market share of viewership is with regards to all of the options that people have to watch television, how many people are really watching PBS, and are we really reaching young people with PBS as opposed to maybe people more in the middle of life?
Mr. Horton?
Certainly. In terms of this initiative looks at power of long form filmmaking as well as short form storytelling in the mix. We see one or two very definitive films that need to be made that would help break down the larger complexity of this, that would be a general audience. Those films can range to take up to 6 months to a year to produce and can range in budgets of $100,000 to $200,000, just in kind of the costs associated with all of those efforts. Films, but they range in time and complexity. But so we do see long form being really powerful. Those films get showed statewide over and over again over 2, 3, 4 years. Some of our films still are effective 5+ years. We think this has a longer shelf life. It will certainly use that is used in a broadcast, so it goes into all the homes across the state. But also is utilized and customized for classroom use. And what we see in classrooms is pieces of that film then are very effective as learning nuggets and objectives. So there's multiple uses that you get even from one film. And so you can kind of start to look at, those are the longer form and those works, and that'll be a part of what public television will do extensive. I'll let Joel talk about, one last thing on reach. It's more than just television, is what I would want to express. This is multimedia, multi-platform, our work. On any given week right now, there's over a million Minnesotans that use our collective services, whether that's in their car, whether that's in their home, whether that's on a mobile device. And so we see the work that we do is being able to be custom made for the power of what works well on this for a younger audience is a custom creation that's certainly not a film, but we are really good at figuring out how this device may deliver messages as well. And so collectively, it's all 87 counties. I think more in terms of reach, I can get you additional details about the demographics, but we service from the smallest minds and young families all the way through to grandparents, great-grandparents, all the way through. And I think for this issue more than anything, too, is those who are directly affected, but also those around who have to know about the information and be aware of what to do. And the audiences that public media reach really are effective and reaching the people who need it the most to help those who need the information. And so I'd love to even provide more data, but it really truly is an impressive ability of using the power of media to reach people. And we share that information to all the other nonprofits and organizations. They take our media freely, and then they redistribute it again on all their platforms. So it has this multiplier effect. Joel, if you come in.
Mr. Glazer. Chair Nelson, Representative Hertaus, we're getting the wrap up, so I'll be brief. We do not reach the masses that TPT and Minnesota Public Television does. We specialize in reaching the underserved, which is part of why we approached and brought TPT to the table. So we are going to be delivering those hardest hit. They're going to be smaller communities in those native communities and the smaller rural communities, but they're going to be the hardest hit. We don't have a lot of students listening. We do have some student programming, not a lot. We have some. That's where we partner with the teachers, and we know that the teachers use things like this based on previous projects like Veterans Voices and MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds. We hear time and time again, especially when we're at the state fair, about how many teachers are using our educational materials.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for that explanation, because I think it's easy to just kind of think about the nomenclature of television and thinking about your normal programming schedule. I had a cabin owner or a resort owner once tell me that his income was limited to 16 cabins times 16 weeks of a season, which is 256 cabin weeks. That was his income stream. And so it's easy to think of television as you have a finite number of broadcast hours and you've got to fill those slots. And so thanks for talking about connecting with this type of device and about using the product in schools, that schools can see the show, and so that the shelf life is longer than it is. And so thank you for that.
Any other questions? Anybody from the audience that wishes to speak on this bill? Seeing no one rushing to the front of the room, I'll renew my motion and we'll hold this over for possible inclusion.
Well, thank you, thank Chairman and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to present the bill.
Thank you.
The next bill on our agenda is House File 1607. And I'll move that we re-refer this to the Committee on Ways and Means with a recommendation that it be re-referred to Capital Investments. Welcome to the committee, Representative Claflin, and when you're ready there, you can present your bill. And why don't you proceed with your testimony and present your bill. And
thank you, Chair. I'm bringing House File 1607 for you today. We did hear this bill as committee last year, and you may remember the crowd of folks wearing their cycling caps in the audience. Some of them did come today as well. I'm bringing this bill because the Velodrome, that's the cycling track at the National Sports Center in Blaine, has reached the end of its life. And this track has hosted international competitions, world champions have trained there, and amateurs have ridden there, including myself. And it is quite an experience to ride that track. The money that this bill would give to the Amateur Sports Commission would help support the Minnesota Cycling Center find a new location for an indoor cycling center and would draft the plans. And that would let us continue this sport, extend our cycling season. Just like today, there's just not a whole lot of good cycling out there. Although I'm sure there's somebody that biked to work today. There's opportunities for youth to engage in healthy activities, and there's also a link to STEM education. And today I have Mr. Jason Lardy from the Minnesota Cycling Center with me, and also a student who will talk about their experience with the track.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jason Lardy. I'm the president of the Minnesota Cycling Center. I'd like to start by apologizing to those of you who may have gotten some spam from us last year. We have a form that our supporters use to submit requests for support to legislators, and someone got in and sent a bunch of messages. So if you got one of those messages, I apologize on everybody's behalf. As Representative Claflin said, the Minnesota Cycling Center is a replacement for the National Sports Center Velodrome, which ended its 30-year run of cycling here in Minnesota this past season. You may have seen some media reports. We had one of our largest crowds ever. We probably had 1,000 people out there to watch on closing night, and some of the best racing that we've had for some time. So it was a kind of a bittersweet evening last August. But the state center, the Minnesota Cycling Center is designed to replace a state-owned wooden velodrome. It's outdoors, as Representative Claflin mentioned. It was built to have a 20-year lifespan back in 1990. Through the hard work and contributions of volunteers, we were able to coax 30 years out of that wooden gem that we had up there. But obviously, time and Minnesota weather takes a toll, and as a result, the facility is closed and it will be torn down later this spring. It has been host to a wide range of events, not just for world champions and national champions, but also for our Velo Kids youth camps. One of our testifiers later on will talk about how we've effectively built the largest women's velodrome cycling community in the United States here in Minnesota. And it's all as a result of the community that's developed around the National Sports Center. And we draw thousands of fans and multiple instances of media impressions, millions of media impressions annually. We've been featured in the New York Times and Sports Illustrated on numerous occasions as well. And we're hoping to build the next phase of track cycling here in Minnesota. The indoor facility makes a huge difference to us, not only because of the weather allowing us to train and race all year round, but more importantly to allow students to have an effective place to race and train during their school year. Right now it's almost impossible for us to bring kids up to Blaine during the school year because either the track is covered with snow or it's just too cold to race up there. So our self-sustaining facility will offer an opportunity for those kids to be engaged in athletic activities after school, but also to create a home for our after-school STEM curriculum. The facility will host multiple events to allow us to be self-sustaining, including concerts, conferences, and more in collaboration with local business partners. We've had two separate feasibility studies done on our business plan, both by the National Sports Center and by Maxfield Research, and they have validated our assumptions on our ability to be self-sustaining and our overall business model. This mixed-use model is something that velodromes all around the world use very successfully to maintain their operations and not require ongoing funding for operations. I mentioned our bike-focused STEM curriculum. We basically teach kids how to ride their bikes and how to maintain their bikes. And while we're doing that, we're teaching them the physics that underlie the basics of bicycling. So when we teach them how to change a tire, for example, we teach them the underlying physics of air pressure and how that helps them. And you'll hear a little bit from Levitt later on this morning. We are seeking a location that's closer to multiple school districts so that we can reach as many students here in Minnesota as possible. As we envision the Minnesota Cycling Center, 287,000 annual visitors will visit, 150,000 people will attend events there. 4,000 student learners will be through our doors, and 400-plus student athletes will compete every year. We believe we'll be able to create more than $8 million in economic impact, more than 100-plus construction jobs, 100-plus ongoing jobs, and create a daily destination for guests from around the neighborhood and from Minnesota. It's important, I think, to put this in the context, though, of the overall cycling enthusiasm here in Minnesota. The Minnesota High School Cycling League has nearly 60 teams that compete in mountain biking in the fall and 2,000-plus riders. It's actually the second fastest-growing sport for high school students in Minnesota behind trap shooting. And Minnesota has produced two Olympic silver medalists and multiple world champions and national champions from juniors to masters to elite racers. House File 1607 is requesting a modest investment that will help us bring the process underway and help to identify potential construction challenges and create opportunities that are presented by the various locations that we have under investment. I'd like to invite Amanda Harvey to join me here as well to share some thoughts. Thank you.
You pull one of the. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Hello. I'm Amanda Harvey. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for holding this hearing to listen to support for the Minnesota Cycling Center. I'm a resident in Minneapolis and have been a racer at the National Sports Center in Blaine for 4 years. I began racing at the track as a way to be active as an adult and to develop goals to maintain my fitness. This has been great for my physical and mental health. I'm a founding member of a track team comprised of women and non-binary folks. We formed specifically to race at the velodrome. When I grew up, my three older brothers played basketball, football, and baseball. I never felt like the quality athlete that they were. Since finding track racing, I have a sport I feel at home in. Racing with and against other women has given me strength, fortitude, and compassion. My competitors are more than just the competition. Off the track, we are friends. We may be on different teams, but we share gear, tactics, and rides to races. The women's field at the National Sports Center Velodrome was the largest in the nation. That was unique, special, and worth preserving. We have had great women track champions in Minnesota, beginning with Dottie Farnsworth in 1895 to Kelly Catlin in the Olympics in 2016. However, most riders at the Minnesota Cycling Center will be everyday Minnesotans like me. To create an environment that will develop champions, a strong community of riders is needed to foster an atmosphere of unconditional support so racers can try hard and discover their best. We have that now, and the Minnesota Cycling Center will continue the valuable work that's already been done. Minnesota is known across the country for its cycling culture. This culture is one of many reasons my husband and I moved back to Minnesota and bought a house after living in Tennessee for 5 years. Destinations for riding bikes across the state of Minnesota have proven to be a spur for economic development, from the Midtown Greenway to the Cuyuna Lakes Mountain Bike Trails in Crosby, Minnesota. Once the National Sports Center Velodrome is torn down later this spring, the nearest velodrome will be in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I would prefer not to have to go to Wisconsin to race track. In closing, Minnesota Cycling Center will provide continuity for the positive and supportive track community, without which my life would be less rich. The Minnesota Cycling Center will be more than just a wooden bowl. It's a place to test your mettle and find your courage. It's a place to become the person you didn't know you were. It's a place where you can see something scary and learn that you can do scary things. I would appreciate if the Minnesota State House would support the Minnesota Cycling Center, because the Minnesota Cycling Center supports all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. And you have I have a Levitt Torres Lima on the.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Levitt is here with us.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record, and then you can proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Levitt Torres. I am a fifth grader at Pillsbury Elementary, and I'm a junior coach for Pedal Power, a biking after school program for fourth and fifth graders in Northeast Minneapolis. I want to tell you about why Pedal Power is so important and how the Minnesota Cycling Center has taught us quite a bit about biking. One of my favorite things about Pedal Power is exploring the city of Minneapolis on bikes. We've bike to the Guthrie Theater, Stone Arch Bridge, Theater Worth Park, and many other parks. Our end of the year ride will be all the way to Stillwater. We get to leave early for that ride. The Minnesota Cycling Center has sent many riders with us on these trips and taught us many things in the classroom about biking. We've learned how to fix flat tires, air pressure, undo and fix chains, how different types of brakes work, the aerodynamics behind bike science and balance. My favorite science experiment was on the seesaw. We were learning about balance, fulcrum, and levers, and how they can affect bikes and riders. We learned quite a bit in the 6 weeks that they came and taught at Pillsbury, and I appreciate them coming to our school. Biking and science can be both fun and go hand in hand together. My favorite thing about Pedal Power is the way we explore the Twin Cities on our bikes, empowering us to become better riders and get some great exercise at the same time. I think it's very important for the Minnesota Cycling Center and Pedal Power to receive money to help them teach future students the same skills that I have learned from them. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Great job. Is there anybody else that would wish to testify? If not, we'll questions. Seeing no questions, I'm going to modify my motion. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. You said before it used to be in Blaine, and I understand you want to move it closer. And I know that there's a lot of major sports facilities in Blaine. So what will happen if you bring this into the metro area, more into the metro area?
Mr. Lardy. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason, the goal is to be as close to as many different school districts as possible so that we can attract the largest number of students in an efficient way. One of the things that we know is challenging for all school districts is transportation. Ideally, we would like students to be able to ride their bikes to the location that we have select. And being able to do that closer inside the Twin Cities is much more effective, obviously, for students. And so it gives us an opportunity to reach new students, especially in underserved communities where we think there are real opportunities, and also to offer kids an opportunity to ride to and from our facility on their bikes.
Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Here's a couple of questions, and I'll just ask them in the interest of time. First of all, this is just for the planning, and so you've already stated you don't really have a spot in mind yet, so you're kind of, you know, grasping out there. But do you have any kind of estimate on what the cost of this is going to be, and is there going to be any kind of a local match, any kind of fundraisers or money coming from anywhere else, or are you going to come back to the state for the money?
Mr. Lardy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thanks for the question. So the first answer to your question is we have evaluated a few different locations, St. Paul, Minneapolis, Eagan, and the Crystal and Plymouth areas have provided opportunities for us to potentially locate there. The money that we use, that we receive, we hope will allow us to validate those locations in terms of their ability to support the facility, as well as to identify the partnership with the community. We've had great support from both the City of St. Paul and City of Minneapolis in our pursuit of a location within their borders. And so we know that there are going to be local contributions or at least local support from those communities. We also believe that there's an opportunity that's been backed up by the feasibility study we had done with the National Sports Center for sponsorships and other private contributions to support the funding to build the facility. We hope to build a facility that would be in the $30 to $40 million range that would allow us to build that world-class racing and entertainment and education venue. And that's generally the range that we've been in.
Representative Green. Any other questions? Representative Keel.
Just a little comment. I really appreciate biking, and I live in rural Minnesota. But when the young lady mentioned that Milwaukee was the next opportunity, I would point out that Milwaukee is closer than the northern part of Minnesota. So if our constituents up in District 1 would like to come down, it's actually closer to 300 plus miles. And so while I appreciate the enjoyment of cycling and really enjoy it myself, actually I learned how to bike on gravel roads. That was the only way my father would let me go see friends. So I had fatter tires. I didn't think that was very cool. But anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me point that out.
Again, I'm no further questions. I have to modify my motion. It was written down here wrong for me. This is going to be held over for possible inclusion in a supplemental bill. So we're going to hold this over for possible inclusion, similar to what we did last year. Again, we heard this bill last year. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
And tell Levity you did a great job. The next bill we have is House File 1740. And Representative Hewitt, the motion should be to refer this to Ways and Means with the recommendation to be put on the general register. If you want to make that motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that HF 1740 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means, recommended that it be placed on the general register.
And I understand you have an amendment here.
Mr. Chair, I do. I would like to move that amendment.
Representative Hewitt moves the DE3 amendment. And with that, do you want to explain what the amendment does and what the bill does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members. I'm glad I made it in on time for this. The roads were terrible this morning.
We might have got here faster if we rode our bikes.
With big tires. Members, this bill is close and personal to me. It's not backed by a lobbying group. It's not backed by any group. Many of you know I took a summer tour this year into many of your communities, and the bill became even more important at that point. What this bill does is it awards the flag on top the Capitol to a in-line duty death of a first responder, basically a public service officer, or a military person killed in the line of duty from Minnesota. Many of you know, and I'll share the story very briefly with you, I'm a member of a Gold Star family. In 1970, November 9th, I came home from kindergarten, turned on the TV to watch Casey Jones. My mom was off that day, it was a Monday, and she was in the kitchen making my lunch. And a knock came onto the door. Naturally, as a five-year-old, you run to the door, you answer it, and excitedly wondering who it is. Unfortunately, this was a guy dressed in a military green outfit. Asked me if my mother was home. My mom rounded the corner. She knew exactly what was going to happen. She knew that she was going to be told that one of the two of her sons that were serving in the military at the time were not going to come home. And that's exactly what happened that day. I remember it just like it was yesterday. The next part of that whole experience I remember is the funeral out at Fort Snelling Cemetery and the flag being presented to my parents on behalf of the president. And those are the two big memories I remember. That flag today, I'm borrowing it from my older brother. It's in my office. And that flag meant so much to our family. We kept it with us through our parents' death, through everyone. And every time I look at that flag, I remember what he died for and what it meant to our family. And that's what this flag program can do. This summer when I took a tour through many of your communities, one of the problems I had, I was looking at the EMS, and we have a couple, I guess, opportunities with EMS in the greater Minnesota. But one of the things I noticed is they think we forgot about them here in St. Paul. They think we've thrown in the towel. And many of them are quitting and leaving. And that's not true. I know many of you, I've got to know you the last year, and I know we all care about them dearly. This is one token, one possible thing we can do for them to show that it's not really about them, but we want to make sure if something does happen to them that we thank their families. And that's what this bill's about. This bill basically thanks their families and gives their families something that the state recognizes their service. At that, Mr. Chair, the amendment, basically what it does is we had some problems with this last year. Administration really is struggling with how to administer this bill. It gives them a year to come up with a program. That we sent over our intern this summer to go over and set up a program with them, so we actually did the program for them. But it gives them a year to implement that. During that year, it will also give them a chance to use up to 50 flags, I believe it is, and those would have to be paid for by the family if they request. I think that starts around September. Then they'll report back to us and say how the program worked and if it's set up to go, and at that point in a year we'll fund it. So hopefully what this is really meant to do, if I'm not here in a year, which could happen, just saying, I want to make sure that this is too important, and it puts something in place that would keep it going. So with that, Mr. Chair, I stand for questions.
Questions? Albright, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hewitt, with regard to your previous statement, could you elaborate in terms of what administration is saying in terms of their difficulty with the flag program?
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, it's my understanding they had trouble with the actual administration of it and how the flag would be delivered, who would do it. It seemed like a very, I'm not sure, Representative Albright, to be honest with you, because it seems like it goes pretty forward. We met with the individual that actually is in charge of the current program that flags the flags above the Capitol, and he seemed to have no trouble. So I can't answer it fully, but I believe this will give them time to adjust to it if they need to.
I think we have somebody coming down here from the administration.
Oh, wonderful.
That maybe can answer that question, and welcome to the... Please identify yourself for the record, and then you can maybe try and answer.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Chris Gibbon. I'm the Director of Facilities Management for the Department of Administration here on the Capitol Complex. So we oversee the buildings, and one of the things we do day-to-day is maintain the flags on the Capitol Complex. And so, our issue was not so much with how to do it. We do it every day, and we fly many flags for specific individuals each year. At this point, they're paid for by the families who want to fly the flags or the individuals. I mean, we fly them for scouts that make the rank of Eagle Scout to people that are retiring. So we really do have a handle on how the protocol would go and how to do that. The issue was the verification for how to determine who died in the line of duty, and that has been fixed by the proposed bill, where the legislators or whoever the constitutional officers that are asking for that make that determination because they know their constituents. That was one of our problems in admin. We maintain the Capitol Complex, and we just don't have a database for who has been killed in the line of duty based on the definitions of that in the statute. So that's what the problem was trying to determine that, which has been solved. And so now it's my understanding there won't be any money that's assigned to this. We're going to fly flags that folks bring in, so we can track that. We can do this study quite easily, where we're logging in how many requests we get, what flag we fly, whether it be the Minnesota flag or the United States flag, the postage cost, because that was another issue. And let me step back for a second. One of the other issues was the overall cost, because we don't know where these people are, so postage is going to vary greatly if it's on the program to provide that postage to get the flag to the family, if it is to be sent directly to them vis-a-vis giving it to the member or the constitutional officer that has requested it. And that option is in there, as it should be. I mean, so we're prepared to do that, but we just don't have a feel for how many people out there. There's probably quite a bit of pent-up demand for this. And so that was our problem a year ago. So I think we've worked through a lot of that, whereby it's clear now the legislature or the constitutional officers would decide what is in line of duty, and we would not question that. If a legislator comes to us and says, hey, we'd like this flag flown for so-and-so who died in line of duty, we're not going to ask the question. We will get it flown. and we will get it to back to the legislator or to the individual, whatever the request is. So this study is going to enable us to kind of track how many requests we get, to catalog that, track the postage fees that would go along with that, and any administrative time, because certainly somebody has to do this. And so we would track that and give the report to you and let you know, hey, you know, here's how many requests we got, here's the types of flags we've flown, here's how much they cost per piece, we know all of that. So here's what the program would cost based on the volume we've done so far. So we could break it down almost to a unit cost, because I would suspect it's hard to anticipate where this would go, but there's probably some pent-up demand, and it will probably level out with time. So that's what it was all about with admin.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, can you give me an idea in terms of how many flags you flew last year?
Mr. Gettys.
Members of the committee, on the order of about 150.
Representative Albright.
You know, if that's truly the case, and they were all for veterans or those that served in the line of duty for the state?
That is not the case.
Okay. Could you have a breakdown for that?
No, we do not track it. People come in, here's my flag, I'd like it flown on the Capitol. My son reached the rank of Eagle Scout, we fly it. Or so-and-so is retiring from the Office of Veterans Affairs, we fly it. We don't track it. We're not paying for the flags. Our people are up there raising them anyway. So it's we don't charge anybody for the labor, and we don't track what flags are flown for whom, because they're their flags. They're not even our flags.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, committee members, I don't object to this bill, but I do think that it is incumbent upon us in the capacity as legislators to and as administration to recognize service rendered to our state, whether that be emergency service through the military or in recognition of a goal achieved that is aspirational, such as Eagle Scout or for that. Representative Hewitt, as I'm looking at this amendment and as the testifier has elaborated in terms of, it sounds like a lot of the issues that I was looking at and that you were looking at have been resolved just by the testimony that has been provided today. So as a friendly amendment, verbal amendment, oral amendment that I might provide to you, and Mr. Chair, why not just remove Section 2 from the amendment itself? Candidly, I think that the administration certainly can undertake raising and lowering the flags without an encumbrance of a fee and include that in the budget that they already have been provided by the legislature. I think in keeping with our recognition of service rendered and to congratulate aspirational goals achieved, I think it's only fitting that we take care of that within the budgets that are provided to our regular agency. So as a friendly offer and recommendation, I might suggest that as an oral amendment, we remove Section 2 for that pilot program and just proceed with the amendment, which I think is very, very worthwhile on the bill itself. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Albright, I'm just trying to make sure that I understand what it is you're saying. Are you saying that the pilot program is something that we all think is a good idea, but that you expect the Department of Administration to absorb these costs? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Claiborne, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you. And to our testifier, you know, every yes is a no. So I feel as though in that making that request, I feel that that would mean you would have to say no to something else. And I would not want you, I would not want the current appropriation to that you have allocated to other things to take away from services. Is that what would happen?
Mr. Givens.
Representative and members of the committee, It's difficult to say that the problem is this. We in facilities management are funded from the lease rates of the tenants on the Capitol complex. We operate as a business. So in a sense, we're having them pay for things that aren't really applying to their day-to-day business. Mm-hmm. So for instance, the Department of Agriculture is housed in the agriculture lab. They're paying for that square footage and whatever it takes us to maintain that facility.
Thank you.
They're not necessarily paying for, and this is a great program. We fully support it. I'm a retired Air Force officer. I get it. But it's not appropriate to ask the Department of Agriculture to be paying for this noteworthy program, and therefore we would see that it needs its own account and its own funding source. So I think the study does the right thing. It tells us roughly how much something like this would cost so that it could be funded, because we don't have the authority to just take lease dollars and fly flags for noteworthy people or their families throughout the state. That's mm-hmm. the issue.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Well, one thing I note here, if we eliminate Section 2, which includes the study and coming back to us, the earliest this program go in effect, because the effective date would then be July 1 of 2021, so it wouldn't be till next July that this program would start. So that's one problem with the amendment as it was stated. Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, just an op-ed on that. Thank you. Last year, as the way that this amendment is written, eight individuals would have been eligible and verified under this amendment. If you charge $35 per flag flown, that's a total cost of $280. I think for the cost of those eight flags, certainly the state can encumber itself for that amount of money to recognize service rendered on behalf of people in EMS and other emergency service personnel. I think it's a bit petty that we're working with dollars when we want to recognize the life served.
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, in risk of the bill not going forward, Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I really appreciate your amendment, but I am too in fear because of what I've experienced with a bill that was supposed to be my first bill, easy bill, no controversy, became a nightmare. And so I cannot accept the amendment at this time, Mr. Chair. I think we have to go through with where we put it to get it going forward.
Representative, well, with that, members, those are questions. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, we didn't move the oral amendment, so we're still on the amendment. Is that correct?
We haven't moved the oral amendment. You made the oral amendment, and with that, members.
I'll just withdraw the oral amendment.
Withdraw the amendment. Okay, the amendment's been withdrawn. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've learned some things here today. And one of the things I've learned is you probably don't even need this bill because they could bring these flags forward anyway. I like the bill. I think it's great. Although I would make the one comment that I have police officers in my family and I know a great deal of them. I think they would, although they would like this, they would probably be more interested in being fully funded and making sure they got somebody to have their back. But that said, I did have the question. You know, you talked about the pent-up people back there. Do you have any idea what that might be? Because this could go back, 20 years or more, I would think, where people would say, hey, this is a great idea. That would be one question. And then the other one, I'll just ask it, because I think we're running short on time. I would think that something like this, as far as the cost of these flags, all you would have to do is go to the public and say, we're looking for donations for flags. You'd probably have a storeroom full of them ready to fly.
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, real quickly. You're right. There is some, the press hasn't picked this up, which is surprising, but the truth is that just in who's picked it up, like VFW posts and stuff, there's also in the bill a stipulation that people can make donations to this program. We don't know what that looks like. We don't know our past deaths right now. I mean, it's going to be interesting. But right now we slotted 50 flags, so somebody may get left out. Maybe no one will. Like Representative Albright said, that there's only there was very few deaths last year, and that's what we really actually are anticipating. So it's the unknown, but I think it's we have a safety block on there for 50 flags. And I will remember that you are all about, you're right, they want funding, so we'll come back to you on that one later, okay?
And Representative Hewitt, this program could be anyone going back to World War II. And I remember in the morning paper there was an article, a piece that there's only three survivors of the Arizona that are still alive. I think the third one just passed away recently. So this could go all the way back to people that served in the military all the way back to World War II. So it could be, like you said, a pent-up demand for this. The idea of a study and figuring out what it's going to cost does make some sense. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Huat. I think your bill is a good bill, but you know, I think the easy solution to this, subdivision 3 in our brief says that it authorizes flag requests to be made by legislators and state constitutional officers on behalf of eligible families. I think I heard in testimony today that anybody who calls the Department of Administration and wants to have a flag that's been flown over the Capitol can get one if they pay for one. And so I think this could be easily instituted to authorize legislators and constitutional officers to be the party that is determining who the eligible family is, that the burden is on the legislator or the constitutional officer. And more importantly, the funding, if it's not already permissible, why not just take it out of any campaign fund for any of those office holders and pay for the flag out of your campaign funds? That would be an easy way to fund this. It would allow the program to go straight forward. And I know that we're allowed to expend resources from our campaign fund for funeral flowers and those types of memorials. So if it's not permissible to buy a flag from our campaign funds, let's add language that tells the campaign finance board it is. And then I think we've got everything resolved.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt, I don't know if it's a suggestion. I know I think what Mr. Givens said is that subdivision 3 that you talked about got to one of the problems they had with the bill last year is who's going to determine whether those people were eligible or not. And so then that's why subdivision 3 is in there, so that we can do that. Representative Quam, you had a question. No. Representative Freiberg.
Pass.
Reply.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hewitt, do you have a Senate author for your bill?
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins. As a matter of fact, I do. It is Senator Lange. Senator Lange has a personal dealing with this. As many of you know, Senator Lange, if you don't, he is a pilot for North Memorial Air Care. This year, North Memorial Air Care lost two of their clinicians, one pilot, one nurse, and they would have been eligible for this program. And so, with that being said, I believe firmly that Senator Lange will get this bill through in the Senate.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a problem. First of all, the fact that the program doesn't exist already boggles my mind in the first place. But the point is that if you're honoring somebody and you...
Can you speak into the microphone?
Oh, so yes. Sorry about that. Usually the flag is given at the funeral or some type of event honoring the death. And the fact that some, like the family, would have to pay for this, it just doesn't seem right to me. It seems to me we ought to be able to pay for that, because definitely the flag is going to be flying above the Capitol in any event. So it just seems like there's got to be an easier way to do this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason. This is not to take place of the flag that is given to military members that drapes a casket or to be This would not be part of any military ceremony. This would be more personal between you and the family as a representative or a senator or a constitutional officer, or maybe the family just chooses to have it mailed out. It's very broad and open in that direction, because I would visualize that a family would say, well, can we fly it on the date of death the next following year or whenever? And it would be very personal if they want you to present it or not. So it's broad and open. It is not to take place of what happens at Fort Snelling, North Shoreditch. That's a whole different different deal, and this is broad open. Other states do this too, and they left it open on purpose just to, it's really personal and should be left up to the family and how they want to present it or if they want it presented. Mr. Chair? Representative Hurtaz signaled to me that I didn't answer his question. I would love to do that.
Well, the representative, I've got.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. Representative Hurtaz, if you want to.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Huat. I look forward to your answer, but I guess I would also ask the Department of Administration, if I currently request a flag and I pay for it, whether personally or out of my campaign funds, you will provide me a flag. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Mr. Givens.
Okay.
Absolutely. We fly them for any occasion. We do not discriminate.
And in the past, as when my sons were in Scouts, I was for a while the advancement chair. When people got their Eagle, we would request flags and pay for them, and then they would fly them, and we'd get them back with the certificate that they were flown over the Capitol. Representative Volga.
No.
I didn't forget about you.
He was going to answer.
Representative Hewitt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hurtaz, not knowing campaign finance as well as you do, new guy, right? So I don't know if you can do this out of your campaign funds or not. I don't have that kind of money, so I probably couldn't do it. But any way you want to pay for this, and if you feel that's legal, that's up to you. But the whole point of this is we can do this now. This won't change what we can do now. It just basically puts an earmark and says, you know what? We care about you. We care about your families. And we're working towards a possible way of putting this in place to pay for it. That's what this whole story is about.
Representative Hurtaz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Huat, just to be clear, I wasn't suggesting that one legislator should pay for the program. I'm just saying that each of us individually, as the occasion should arise where you want to recognize somebody, most likely in your district, that you pay for a flag. And we can do the very thing that you're talking about, honoring that individual and pay $24 or $25, whatever it is, out of campaign proceeds to honor that. I can't imagine that with the funeral expenses and flowers permissible in memoriam, that a flag doesn't fall under the same category, but we certainly could get an advisory opinion from campaign finance board or put it in this bill that it is now a covered expense.
Mr. Representative Hurtaz, I've been informed by staff here that it is a permissible use of our campaign funds already, so we don't need to open that ball up and create more problems for the bill. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I totally support this. You know, we talk about all of the money that we spend. Here we're chatting about, and I'm fiscally as conservative as many, but I'm looking at this thinking, here we are spending all this time on something that is absolutely the right thing to do. I do have a question on a fiscal note, because I'm looking at this look and seeing that we're going to spend $15,800 a year for additional employees. But what I'm also hearing is, if this goes into effect, what I'm also hearing is that anybody that brings a flag can get it flown for free. So just a little clarification, why would we have an additional cost in a fiscal note if indeed this could be done for no charge anyway?
My understanding is the fiscal note was written to the original bill. I don't know. It hasn't been modified to the amendment, and I'm not sure. Mr. Givens can understand answer that question.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes. I mean, when fiscal notes are prepared, we tie every single element of cost to that. And so when you're looking at the actual operation, there is time where somebody has to log that in, somebody comes and gets the flag, goes up to the top, and flies it. And so therefore, from a costing perspective, that's what the program costs.
And Representative Vogel, I know from my one brother who spent some time in doing that at the U.S. Capitol when he was in the Army. They have Army people, military people that are actually doing that all day long, putting flags up over the Capitol, taking them down, putting flags up, and that's all they do all day long for all the requests that go out there for people for flags that were flown over the U.S. Capitol. So I'm not sure how much more we'd demand we'd have, and that's probably is built into the estimate of what time and additional staff that they might need. Representative Vogel.
Well, just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I guess my point was that, to me, this is one of the more valuable things, the more memorable things we can do as a state. And we're already not going to charge other people. Why would we think about adding a cost for this? So I think we just have to find a way to get this done. It's not that much money, unfortunately, relative to whatever we talk about. This, to me, is just a thing that needs to be done. And we can't get into a thing with Department of Administration and make this a bigger deal than it is. Thank you.
Representative Hewitt, we want to wrap up?
I sure do. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your, I think, overwhelming support on this bill. It's just a matter of how we land it, right? And so hopefully you'll move it on to Ways and Means. And again, I appreciate your support for not only all Gold Star families, but for my EMS family and first response family, too. Thank you.
And Representative Hewitt renews his motion that House File 1740 be re-referred to Ways and Means with the recommendation that be placed on the general register, and that's House File 1740. Oh, we have to vote on the DE3 amendment. Okay. Mm-hmm. All in favor of the DE3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
The amendment passes. And again, House File 1740 as amended. Refer to Ways and Means. You want to renew your motion?
I renew my motion to move House File 1740 to the Ways and Means Committee for possible to refer to the floor in the general ledger.
As amended.
Thank you.
All in favor of House Files of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill is referred to Ways and Means. With that, members, we are adjourned.